Good Monday to you all, and welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch in the 718. We've got Nick Gillespie checking in from the Real America. Nick, you're in a Walmart parking lot. Is that true?
Yeah, it's, you know, I think I'm seeing the Real America out here, but I'm in the 513 area code, the sexy southwestern Ohio area, the swath between Portsmouth to Cincinnati up to the Golden Triangle of Dayton, whose NFL team, whose proto-NFL team actually used to be called the Triangles. It's fascinating,
really?
Isn't it? Yeah. The Dayton Triangles.
We need more the Real America commentary at the top of each and every one of these podcasts. In the Beltway Swamp, in a small swampy closet, we've got Catherine Mangu Ward and Peter Suderman. Y'all cozy in there?
202.
There's actually an alligator in here. It's so swampy.
Stop calling me an alligator.
Before we get started with this podcast, my 9-year-old informed me that there are no alligators in the New York sewers.
Subway system?
And subway system. So she's not taking any of that fake news. Reminder to all of you, before you unsubscribe after having heard this intro, subscribe over at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today we are hoping to preview Tuesday's State of the Union address by President Donald Trump, officially his first, although really his second. I don't believe in that nomenclature. We will also game theory some DACA deal points negotiated out right here. Hopefully discuss recent Trumpy moves on tariffs and trade. But before all of that, I have got a lot of problems with last night's Grammy telecast, and you people are going to hear about that right now. I actually watched it like Nick did, for some reasons, glutton for punishment in our middle age. And the first half of the show was actually pretty good. There was like some nice performances. Kendrick Lamar, I don't know what he's talking about, but it seemed pretty interesting. Lady Gaga was saying a lot of good stuff. There's a country band called Little Big Town. They sing real purdy. And then there was like an hour-long gruesome slog of political claptrap, culminating with, and if you haven't looked at your social medias or you didn't watch this on television last night, I'm not making the following thing up, culminating with a reading from Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury book by Hillary Clinton. This actually happened. Nick, since you are even more of a glutton for punishment than I am, and also a very shrewd observer of pop culture phenomenon, as evidenced by your post already this morning on the topic, what was the very worst thing last night telecast that you saw?
You know, actually, I think it was when the host, James Corden, interviewed his parents, and they had like a bit about how his parents snuck out of the Grammys to go see Hamilton. And he's from England or Canada or Australia or something. So, you know, they're foreigners, so they're kind of funny. But I love politicized award shows. I think they're great. And this one, the Hillary Clinton thing was truly awful because it had nothing to do with music. Janelle Monáe at one point got up and gave a speech about Me Too and Time's Up and all of that, which is kind of weird. You know, Kendrick Lamar, he wants Jay-Z for president. And it's like, you know, Jay-Z really knows how to punch women. So I guess that's going to work out pretty well. It gets very confusing very quickly when you start virtue signaling in these experiences. But, you know, come on. Like, what Academy Award moments do you remember more than, you know, things like Vanessa Redgrave talking up to PLO or Sasheen Littlefeather going up to accept an award in place of Marlon Brando? You know, that's good stuff. And the Fire and Fury thing that bugged me the most about that is that it had nothing to do with music. I mean, they had John Legend and what's his name? DJ Khaled in on it, but it was mostly about Hillary Clinton. And it's like, that's not just wrong. It's so wrong because Hillary Clinton is, you know, if you lump politicians into, they're either pro-pop culture or anti-pop culture, there is virtually no one who comes close to touching her on being anti-pop culture. She's a person who railed against various times rap lyrics as well as especially video games. As Matt, you pointed out in a story about her censorious, policy positions over the course of her career. And then the weirdest thing if I may, was that Lord, the I guess she's New Zealander, who was up for Album of the Year, a good performer, a popular performer who crosses a lot of genre and has a wide audience, was the only person, also happened to be a woman, who didn't get to perform live solo for Album of the Year, which, you know, but you have time for Hillary Clinton. It's like, you got to be kidding me. It really is awful.
Suderman, you were a musician in your previous life, probably at a fish restaurant in Florida. you're a movie reviewer in this life, in addition to being a policy wonk. Here's my question. Is this not all, I mean, the kind of uniformity of the politics of this, is this not just all part of the big sort? Is this like not Team Red and Team Blue choosing to pick sides in America? Is this at long last the free market at work, Peter Suderman?
I mean, is the free market deciding that Bruno Mars is the best musician in America? If that's the case,
he's pretty good.
Like, that's a market failure. That's, and I'm, as even as a libertarian who doesn't believe in,
you know, you're just anti-Filipino Hawaiians.
This is, Peter is now speaking in the proud tradition of Ayn Rand's early work, right? Like, her heroes are not rewarded by the market for their clearly evident artistic virtues.
There needs to be more Rachmaninoff.
Basically, what I'm saying is, yes, more Rachmaninoff at the Grammys.
I mean,
no, but Peter, regardless of Bruno Mars, who made the point late in the evening, like, hey, you know what? Glad to see some dance music up here instead of all these damn ballads that we're playing that were all, so, you know, that you could tell that, and I'm stealing this from like Uncle Dynamite on Twitter, but you could tell that it was an important moment that we should all get the feels for when they had a bunch of normal looking people on stage joining whatever singer. It's like, oh, okay, this is powerful. Artistic stuff aside, Peter, I'm talking about the political sorting in which Hollywood has this team. This team is Hollywood, politically speaking, and we have to have long discussions about the politics in our celebrations of the culture.
I think some of that is a little bit inevitable, just sort of in the structure of the two parties and in the kind of the shape of the business of being a creative entertainer. And in a world in which one of the parties has basically said, we don't really like pop culture and modernity and like the sort of the pop culture stuff. And that's the Republican Party. And yes, Democrats have absolutely been awful on video games, on, you know, censoring certain stuff. And yes, absolutely. You know, Tipper Gore was the woman who sort of gave us the parental warning label. But in 2018, it is the Republican Party that is the anti-Hollywood. We don't like them coastal liberals. We don't like people who live in cities. We don't like the sort of the creative entertainment industry. And so when you have that as one of the, as like a kind of defining feature of one of the political parties and its base, and then on the other hand, you also have a creative industry that is built around at least nominally, at least sort of in self-conception, perhaps not in actual reality, but at least in self-conception on celebrating a kind of ethnic, gender, right, sort of a self-expressive diversity. Which I think, again, you know, if to the extent that it is practiced truly, is a very good thing. And so when you have an industry that is built around that, then it is very hard for that industry to not go pretty hard on the political party that is kind of aligned against them. And I think it's stupid and it shouldn't be that way and it doesn't have to be that way. And there is like there is a world that you can imagine in which conservative and libertarian art dominates, pop culture, and in which all of these categories also don't exist in this way, in which we don't think of art as conservative or libertarian or liberal in this
sense.
Thank
God.
And like in which
now,
it's scrambled.
I mean, why are you
lumping
libertarians in with conservatives, though, Peter? Very few libertarians who are like anti-rap music.
Because Hollywood does.
John McCain still is.
I totally agree. I'm not saying that conservatives and libertarians are together. What I'm saying is that Hollywood is liberal and that Hollywood is not libertarian. And so libertarian is being largely left out of this. And that doesn't mean that there are no libertarian types. I think that a sort of a better and more interesting and more sort of politically and not a Hollywood that was less shallowly politically engaged would probably end up being somewhat, perhaps not radically, but somewhat more libertarian, at least in sort of pockets and corners. The kind of, you know, shallow, smug self-regard that you see at award ceremonies, that is like condensed and heightened at award ceremonies, means that in a year in which there is a president who is just universally hated by kind of coastal entertainment professional types, and who is just like, who has aligned his party against them, I think it's sort of it's hard to escape that. It sucks. It's not, I don't like it at all. But
there's
but
a reason. Like, can I ask both you and Catherine? And I have to admit, I only watched the Grammys because I knew we were going to talk about it. But like, why didn't you watch the Grammys? Part of this is larger than all of this. Drudge is leading with a headline in red, all caps, saying, you know, worst Grammy ratings ever. Who gives a shit about these kinds of shows? I mean, these are our parents and grandparents' award shows. Like, who cares anymore? And is that because of politics, or is it because of, we have better stuff to do?
Let me pivot
that to Catherine, in the sense of like, you never watch this kind of, you haven't like turned on your television since 1974, and it's not clear that you were born then. And so when you see stuff like this, and you know that the Federalist is just going to be cooking with gas on this all day long, do you just sort of feel like an alien in your own land as people get into their kind of predictable grooves talking about all this stuff?
You know, I used to, but now I feel like I have a lot of company among the cord cutter, insufferable, I don't watch TV sets. So I'm happy to have that company. No, I don't watch award shows for a very particular reason, which is that I have an extremely low empathetic embarrassment threshold. And so when I watch people be idiots on television, it makes me want to die, and then I mute it. So I've finally learned that I can just look at a slideshow of the dresses online the next day, and that is the only content I want to consume. So the dresses were pretty good. I was happy to see that people were back in color now that the Me Too thing is a white rose instead of a black dress, because arbitrary signaling is awesome. Here's my bid, though. I want to kill the spoken word Grammy, because I think the spoken word Grammy is the place where politics has, like, It's the most obvious place that politicians sneak into this party, right? Like, Al Gore is going to EGOT before anybody else. Like, he's going to get all the awards, and it's going to be because of the fucking spoken word Grammy. Obama's gotten it. Jimmy Carter's gotten it. Obama's gotten it again. Bill Clinton's gotten it. Al Franken's gotten it. Like, this is the slot where they let the politicians in to the fun party that was just supposed to be fun musicians, and that has to stop.
That was actually the setup to the Fire and Fury joke. It was like, hey, yeah, since we've had all of these presidents,
exactly,
before, then it's it might be Trump's turn next year. And that kind of, I think, gets us naturally into a State of the Union address thing, in which when we are allowing politicians to loom this large, probably the worst moment, politicized moment of the Grammys yesterday, which won't get nearly the Drudge headlines on it, was a setup by the host, James Corden, who's from a not America Stan, yeah. I think.
Because
Nick, is the exact,
I guess, like,
from
hosting late night shows along with cleaning my gutters is work that Americans won't do.
Yeah, they actually did have Trevor Noah on there at some point, too. No, he did this big setup, like, at our next speaker, for 8 years as president, he taught us to learn how to hope and change. He's the 44th president. And the crowd in Madison Square Garden. And speaking of which, just a sideline, Nick, totally embarrassing how much, like, New York state of mind, hey, we're back in New York, crap in there. Just really embarrassing.
Yeah.
Oh, let's get the Broadway people on. Anyways,
although Matt, I want to tell you that Miss Patti LuPone has incredible pipes.
Oh my God.
Those are pipes you could eat off of.
Singing
a very
egg.
Political song, the big production number from Evita, which last time I checked was like, Evita is a play that's about whether straight up Marxism in the form of Che Guevara or fascism in the form of Peronistaism is the right way to go.
See, that's the kind of political art that I can support.
Agree.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can imagine is that poor Madonna, poor Madge, was at home just like slamming tequila shots as she's airbrushed out of history in the Grammys. Anyways, So Corden sets up this joke as if it's going to be an introduction of Barack Obama, and it turns out to be an introduction of the just horrifying president of the Grammys, who comes out and gives one of the longest and worst speeches of the night, full of politics. However, the embarrassing part was the groundswell of absolute giddy, like, you know, shrieking, my God, it's the Beatles in 1963, happening from these most powerful entertainers in the world. So, Catherine, as a naked State of the Union pivot, what the hell? Can Jesus we get Christ. Out of
naked
this
and afraid State of the Union pivot, please?
Naked and afraid, fetal position State of the Union. No, we've just presidented ourselves to death here. And the State of the Union is part of that process. It didn't used to be a speech in Congress. It used to be a letter by a president for more than 100 years. As
well, they also didn't have TV back then, too. You know, it didn't used to be broadcast. That was what was good. You know, you didn't have to worry about James Polk ruining your late January.
Is there? He ruined a lot of Mexican late January.
Yeah, I was going to say, you still didn't have to worry about that, just not in speech form. But
is there anything? Is it too late? Like, can we de-presidentify ourselves in any useful way anymore?
Right. So, a couple things that we can do to de-presidentify ourselves. First and foremost, we got to stop calling former presidents Mr. President still. Like, does that not just kill you when people are like, oh, it's Mr. President to like Bill Clinton? It's like, he's not the president anymore. He's just some guy now. That's literally the whole point of America. Like, that is what George Washington worked for, my friends. He's just a guy. He's going to go sit under his vine and fig tree or whatever. So, first, let's de-president the former presidents. I think we can all agree on that. Second, definitely State of the Union should go back to being a letter that's run like in all of the nation's newspapers. In Trump's case, if he wants to do it via a Twitter thread, that would be fine. They set this up now. He's got 280 plus awesome. Threads. It'll be there's plenty there.
He could do it from bed.
He could do it from bed, which is what he likes to do. That sounds great.
I'm assuming that that he tweets from bed is a euphemism. Which
no,
is something
it's not.
Even more disturbing.
We wish it was a euphemism. Literally, that could mean anything else, and it would be better than just actually the thing he does, which is actually tweet on Twitter.
I'm
from
assuming
his bed.
He's tweeting from the John, obviously.
Shorter State of the Unions, clearly. Like the laundry list State of the Union is like a plague on our times. There should be just like, 10-minute mission statement for America and then out. Like they can put out press releases afterward.
So it's like it's got to be a TED Talk.
It should be a TED Talk.
Oh,
yes.
God, yeah.
Yes. TED Talks are so over. We are past peak TED by like about 5 years, but that's the right
that's
time
perfect.
For politics to get in.
I would love to see Trump doing the power stance and just doing a TED Talk.
Power pose. And also I recently learned because of an article that appeared in the print issue of the magazine, Everybody Drink. I did my print promotion for the podcast.
Nice. Thank you.
This month that the most viewed TED Talk ever, which is due mostly to Path Dependence because it was also one of the first TED Talks they released online, is a TED Talk called Is School Killing Creativity? And the answer is yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes. 15 minutes, everything you need to know. Yes. TED Talk, SOTU. Matt, tell me you're with me.
Can I suggest that Trump is actually de-presidentifying the presidency? And it seems counterintuitive because the media is obsessed with him. But in fact, and I hope to write something along these lines today or tomorrow, but, you know, he didn't get a lot done. To the extent that he got stuff done, I mean, there's obviously the tax bill is a huge thing, and that's important. But he, you know, some of his some executive orders were repealed. But he is slowly kind of decertifying the president as the first arm of government or the first part of the federal government. I think he's shrinking the stature and also the effectiveness of the executive office. I mean, I wish that he would just get rid of the State of the Union. But, I think we're going there.
But like when Cory Booker becomes president, we're going to blow it all right back up.
It's going to be the Grammys. He's just going to deliver the State of the Union at the Grammys. It's going to bleed over from Sunday. It's going to be like like a 48-hour festival.
He's going to get one of those.
It starts Sunday night with a Bruno Mars performance and ends in Washington in Congress, like with like a parade.
Will there be
and
a ceremonial
and you know what?
Passage
Actually,
down 95?
Look, that's what Bruno Mars should be doing for America.
The Trump, you know, Trump had Congress behind him and couldn't get anything done. Barack Obama didn't have Congress behind him, but when he did, he passed a couple of things. And then everything he did after the first 2 years was essentially or mostly through executive order or executive action. That's not a sign of a strong president. I mean, it's a would-be imperial presidency, but it's actually a sign that, like, you know, the president really can't move Congress to his position. I'm trying to be optimistic here, especially after the Grammys. And
is that what this is?
Lord, not even getting to perform.
Well, I think that we weren't really scheduled here to talk about the Mueller investigation, even the news over the weekend that apparently Trump had decided to fire Mueller and his special investigation back last June, and then was talked out of it by a series of people who said that they were going to resign if he followed through on it. Even his attempts to kind of thwart or tamp down the investigation into himself are signs that the non-presidential institutions still have some life in them and are kind of finding their backbone. It's the there's a theory, and it's not a theory that I enjoy, but it kind of piggybacks on to what Nick has said, and I've seen a lot of places elsewhere of like, Trump is diminishing the luster of the presidency in a really kind of gross way. That's the point. We like that. So it's the phrase that I keep trying to sell and no one's buying, the elephant man of the beauty pageant. Like, I want to bring this ugly thing to discredit the actual ceremony that you people have been buying into after all these years. But Peter, damn you all to hell. There are actual policy things brought up in State of the Union addresses, many of which, like various trips to Mars, kind of fall apart. Although now, I mean, maybe Catherine will update us on our Mars expedition activities here in the world. But last year, and this didn't get a lot of press, Trump spent three paragraphs in a State of the Union address, and he even had a Lenny Skutnik out in the audience to illustrate this. Go Google it, kids. About how we should reform the Food and Drug Administration in a way to unleash and speed up the discovery of drugs and kind of just turn that regulation state on its head and unleash innovation even beyond the FDA and everything. It was pretty that was a more libertarian stretch about the FDA than it had ever existed in any State of the Union address previously. And it kind of presaged, I don't know how to pronounce that word, regulatory activities of the presidency. So given that, and given other things, what would you hope to see, Peter Suderman, policy-wise, in this State of the Union address? Or are you just going to be making perfectly measured cocktails and drinking yourself to oblivion? Before, I should point out, we're going to have a very special edition of this very podcast the moment the State of the Union address drops, and it's going to be on Facebook Live and Reason and elsewhere, and we're excluding Nick on purpose because he's in a Walmart parking lot huffing glue. Peter, you go.
I'll be making cocktails for everyone, not just for myself, and in fact, I'll be making them extra strong for everyone else just in hopes of making the post-game podcast a little bit more interesting. No, I think my ideal State of the Union is exactly the opposite of Catherine's. What I would like from the State of the Union, ideally, is basically for the president to read a white paper, like with an introduction.
Do you hate only yourself or all of America?
No, I love myself and I hate everyone else. And like what I really want is like a 45-minute intense discussion of one major policy with two sub-policies underneath it. And what that would do is two things. Like, I want it to be kind of like, think of like your ideal, like extended health affairs feature or like a 70 page Congressional Budget Office report on the long term deficits and options for reform. Like that sort of thing is what I'm really going for here. And I'm actually pretty serious. Ideally, it would involve as well, like a bunch of kind of inscrutable charts and graphs that then we could pore over afterwards. The White House would release this whole thing as a presentation, as a PowerPoint on whitehouse.gov, and you could go and download it, you know, the minute that the State of the Union was over. And what this would do is two important things. One is that it would make everyone who is interested in the theater and like the sort of the pomp and drama and this the public presentation of all of it, everyone would tune out. And that would be a good thing. Like, people would stop giving a shit about the State of the Union, except the people who cared about what the State of the Union said. It would make the State of the Union, on the one hand, not matter as kind of fluffy bullshit. And on the other hand, it would make the State of the Union matter a lot as a specific extended policy proposal. And I think that this would be a good exercise for any president, but especially someone like Donald Trump, who doesn't really seem to grok like the very basic policy details of his own administration or the stances of his senior advisors or even of himself. But to actually just sort of go through and read this and prepare this over time and use it to make one or sort of like one big proposal, maybe with a couple of sub proposals built in underneath it. And this would be, I think, a good thing for the executive branch, for Congress to kind of have to sit there and listen to an extended policy proposal. And it would also be good for the political press, who wouldn't cover this as, well, is Trump going to regain the narrative? Like, it would be like, no, actually, Trump is going to reform the FDA in these three ways, and here's how he's going to do, or whatever it is. And I think this would be good for Democrats, for Republicans, for America, for Congress, and most of all, for me.
So here's the thing, though. This is two different visions of the presidency.
God, what a one selfish, is selfish man.
In Peter which Sitterman. The president basically becomes like America's ceremonial appendix, right? Like the goal is the president just like ascends to a kind of Queen of England type plane where like he doesn't really have any influence or power and just like is a symbolic person that people get all their symbolic jollies out on. And that means that the State of the Union is like, America is an idea about eagles or whatever. And then like, that's it.
Please continue that. I want to hear the rest of that speech. I've give up. Yours is better.
You
Your
like
idea
my way
is
now,
better.
Right? Your way implies that the president is a technocrat who can come up with good specific policies, control people's lives effectively, and implement those policies through the tools of the state. That's not a thing anymore. Maybe it never was.
The executive branch has to implement policy.
Less executive branch,
less speech. It has to implement policy.
Less
president. It should implement better policy and probably less policy, but it has to implement some policy.
Eagles.
I do kind of like Catherine's idea. If I can go full Louis C.K. here and say, like, the idea that the president become kind of like a Bukkake model for the country, and we just project onto him whatever ideal vision of America we have.
Wow, this podcast today, guys.
I don't know what happened to our lives. Don't Google that one. Friends.
Somebody on Facebook just suggested that Country Music Awards they can have country music artists read from Jordan Peterson's new book.
Which I have literally in my hands right now. 12 Rules for Life. Antidote to Chaos.
Is that... never mind.
Antidote to Chaos.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that's going to be talked about in this State of the Union address for sure is going to be immigration policy, which is making all of the headlines for understandable reasons. So Peter, wonky friend here, and also political observer friend, it strikes me as someone who's covered the rise and fall of a couple of different efforts to come up with comprehensive bipartisan immigration reform, TM, that the big difference this year, and it's interesting and it's big enough that I don't think that people are really digesting it fully yet, is that this is the first time that we've seen the real kind of polar opposites or the antagonists in the debate who hate each other's guts and think of each other as having absolutely bad and the worst possible faith are the ones negotiating. Like before, it was, hey, let's get John McCain to negotiate with Teddy Kennedy, at least until John McCain has to run for president. Then he'll lateral it over to John Kyle and pretend like he never had anything to do with it. They were basically centrist type of moderates. The Gang of Eight in 2013, it was a bunch of Lindsey Grahams and Jeff Flakes and Marco Rubios and these types of rhinos, you know, from the perspective of kind of National Review conservatism in terms of their approach towards immigration. But this is Steve Miller negotiating, or, you know, Tom Cotton more concretely negotiating with Democrats who call them all a bunch of racists. Given that, this ain't going to happen, is it? Or what do you think about the sort of political possibilities of that bridge being that gap being bridged? Thank you, Catherine. By March 5th or whatever the deadline is.
I think a DACA deal is a bridge to nowhere, or a surely there's a Steve Miller Band reference here.
Old jet airliner.
Probably the most. I really don't understand. Maybe this is a FedEx kind of like air overnight situation.
Skip it. Just keep going.
Okay.
It's
so
a joker, a smoker, and a midnight toker.
Why would you do this?
You know, it's like a team up with Bob Seger. A joker, next time. A smoker, and a midnight toker is Ross Douthat, who wrote a really fascinating highly disagreeable column about Stephen Miller and immigration, and basically argued that, you know, in the past, all of the immigration deals that have been negotiated have been between, as you said, Matt, very centrist folks, kind of all of whom more or less share the idea that we should basically legalize the people who are here, kind of create paths to legalization and to citizenship eventually, throw some money at border security, and like that's pretty much the deal, and perhaps even, you know, and maybe like expand opportunities for immigration overall. And Ross's point is that he has been making for months now, perhaps even longer than that, is that, you know, about a third of the country thinks that we should actually reduce immigration levels. And so having Stephen Miller, who is the White House's point person on immigration, who is behind the deal that was offered last week, having that person at the table, Ross argued, might be like a path to a deal, actually, because it might create a kind of a sustainable something that the whole country could reasonably embrace, though perhaps not all love. I think the problem with Ross's column was that he had it, maybe if he had it right, it was half right. It was that restrictionists probably, yes, they're like, if we're going to sort of just assume a kind of small d democratic process in which the whole country gets a voice. On the one hand, you know, like restrictionists are going to be part of that. I totally disagree with them wildly. Like, and I wish that they, you know, I wish that we could just sort of assume them out of the conversation and move on. But they're here and they exist and they have some political influence. The problem is Stephen Miller himself is not just any restrictionist. He is someone who is really kind of difficult. People don't like don't like working with him. He's kind of a troll. He is an immigration policy troll. And so the idea that you are negotiating with a troll, and not just negotiating with him, but that person is running the White House's immigration policy and is basically responsible because Trump has to give cover to in order for the House to vote on anything, in order for House Republicans to kind of come on board. He is basically deciding what the immigration policy kind of red line is going to be, and that power ends up entirely vested in him, or almost entirely, because Trump himself is like not reliable or kind of he's clueless on all of this stuff at best. And so I think the real problem is not again, as much as I very strongly disagree with the restrictionist position, the issue is not, should there be a restrictionist voice in this debate? The issue is, should that voice be Stephen Miller's? And to me, the answer is very clearly no. But he's the guy in the White House. He's got Trump's ear, and he's kind of he has the point position in terms of the negotiating. And so I think that's going to create real problems.
Nick, you didn't like the column. Let me get you with a follow up on the kind of one of the premises of it, or like let's put you in the negotiating chair. We just graduated Nick Gillespie. You know, the Koch brothers wormed him into the White House, because that's what they do with Nick, generally speaking. And you are part of the negotiations. And the negotiations are, we will legalize, maybe through a lot of arduous hoop jumping, but we will legalize those DACA recipients, and maybe more from the overall pool of kids who were brought here by their parents illegally at the time. And we'll do that. But in return, we are going to cut in a noticeable way the current flow of legal immigration. Do you, Nick Gillespie, take that deal?
No, I don't.
You are going to let those kids be subject to deportation, Nick Gillespie. That's what you're going to do? You're saying that these kids, these 700,000 mm-hmm. people who volunteered their information to the federal government in order to qualify for this temporary executive order protection kind of program, who are now going to be shortlisted for ICE agents to come and put them away on trucks or their parents or both, that's worth it to you because you just want to get your lettuce
plant. Here is the issue, and you know, Peter is right that you need to have all sides at the table if you're going to get a deal. I suspect, and like Peter, I'm the opposite of a restrictionist. I think that when I say I'm for open borders, I mean anybody who comes here who doesn't have a communicable disease or a criminal past should be allowed to come here and live and work legally. And that solves almost all of the problems, as we've talked about a lot at Reason. You know, if you deal with immigration within the framework of prohibition, when you create a black market in people, you create many, many more problems than you solve when you create a black market in drugs or booze or whatever. And the easiest fix to that, because immigration flows actually go up and down, and, you know, we are now in a situation where more Mexicans are leaving the country than entering. For a variety of reasons, illegal immigrants don't really care whether or not they are legal or not. I mean, they're motivated by larger forces. The real question should be, how do we minimize the social costs of immigration? And one of the ways to do that is by making it more open and more easy. I'm all for getting rid of family reunification as the main basis of immigration. I think, you know, people should be able to bring their spouses and minor children to the country. And after that, it's probably better to open it up to everyone rather than simply people who are related to one another. So this is a long way of just saying that the whole DACA debate frames the issue in a way that is pretty smart for restrictionists, because now they have a leverage point on people along the lines of what you just said, Matt. But I think the bigger issue is to take a step back and also to bring in big and small business, because one of the things that hasn't gotten enough discussion here is the whole role of E-Verify. And when people talk about, oh, we're going to build a wall and we're going to, you know, increase sanctions against, we're going to secure the border, the main way that that's going to get done is by implementing and rolling out completely E-Verify and things like Real ID, all of these things that Republicans, even in the early years of the 21st century, were very much against, because these represent a unprecedented reach of the federal government into very day-to-day business operations, as well as, everything that you do will be based around a secure national ID card and the government saying, okay, it's okay, you can work here. And I think we need to shift the conversation away simply from DACA and this first, you know, this idea that if we don't do something, you know, by, March 5th or March 6th, we're going to be getting rid of 700,000 people. That's the wrong way to frame this debate.
Yeah, I think I just want to add a little bit that E-Verify is really awful and even worse than, I mean, I think a lot of people sort of recognize. It's not Nick says, it kind of gets involved in every employment decision, and it gets between workers and employers, it puts the government in between there, but it also puts the government in between workers and employers and then gets stuff wrong. And it gets stuff wrong really quite consistently. And so the error rate is around 4.1% according to government statistics, Social Security Inspector General. And That means that's probably a conservative estimate. And what that means is that a lot of people will be prohibited from working, even though they actually are legal and pass this test, just because the system botched it. And so that's just like, that to me is a huge, huge problem, that we would subject people to a test that is just quite consistent, that has like a high enough error rate that it's going to create real headaches and months.
We're talking of millions of
people
being dislocated from the workforce, you know, on a daily basis.
And not even because they're illegal, but because the system screwed up.
And to be clear, that's everyone who works would be subject to that. Catherine, one of the things that Shikadalmia has pointed out, which I think is pretty interesting, dealing with family or so-called chain migration, is that even though you might have a lot of olds involved and also some youngs, that statistically they end up doing pretty well precisely because they're not tethered to a specific job, and kind of it isn't micromanaged their behaviors when they're here. They come with their family and they are in a community and they sort of figure it out. They have more latitude to figure it out than people who are more tethered to a job. But just to build on what both Peter and Nick just said, talking about
E-Verify.
Just to back up with Peter and Nick, we were just saying, talking about E-Verify, and grappling with what is going to be, if anything passes, it's not going to be some kind of clean up and down bill about a thing, I don't think. It's going to be more comprehensive. Well, as far as I can tell, every single one of these almost passed but never really got their passed bills, the Gang of Eights, the 2006 initiatives and stuff, included heaps of E-Verifies. It included lots more border wall spending. It included, as did the 1996 immigration acts that were passed, included a lot of stuff that's terrible from a civil libertarian point of view and just from an anti-statist point of view. And so, dear Catherine, do we have any hope that a bill here would not include a bunch of really terrible crap? And if so, how do you wrap your mind around that? Do we trade the terrible crap for not deporting kids or a bunch of other people here?
Yeah, all these bills do have terrible crap in them. And I think the thing that's different about this round of discussion is that both parties have really leaned into this idea that there are these good immigrants that we want to keep around. And in this case, it's the Dreamers, right? It's this, okay, they were basically raised here. They're basically American. It's not their fault that they're here. So let's let them stay. They're the good immigrants. And I think that creates this mindset that, like, they're the bad immigrants, that there are these ones who just, you know, came across the border illegally and, you know, what part of illegal don't you understand and all that. And, you know, I think the statistics around the chain, the so-called chain migrants, show that that's a mistaken way of looking at these things. Because actually, as you say, so 2/3 of people who come on chain migration, on family-based migration, are children or spouses, right? So that's really family reunification, which is the initial kind of idea of that law. I think you're very hard pressed to make a moral case against that. Not that Republicans won't try, but even the other people that come over as siblings, as adult siblings in particular, have super good outcomes. This is partially because people who come here and know they can bring their families, or who come here and join their families, are fully engaged in being American residents and hopefully eventually citizens. And there is a lot to say for that. Make people invest in the idea that they're going to stay in their neighborhood, in their town, in their state, in their country. The other piece of it, though, is this idea that, again, the good immigrants and the bad immigrants, we can let the good ones in, but then we have to spend more money and do more things to keep the bad ones from ruining everything. And that's where you get the border wall spending and the E-Verify and all that. You know, I think it's fundamentally a wrong mindset. You know, even the bad immigrants are pretty good. Immigrants are like pizza, but and pizza is from immigrants, so it all comes out nicely in the end. But I don't think that we're going to be able to work our way out of that mindset in time to get some kind of a deal done. Shika's reporting on how E-Verify has played out in Arizona is particularly telling. They basically implemented it, screwed it up so bad that they rolled it back, and are now systematically and in a politicized way punishing people who hired people that they checked against the bad E-Verify database, even if the database cleared them, if they later turned out to be illegal. We can expect to see that nationwide after this
My prediction, and this is where Stephen Miller, I don't think, is driving the bus as much as, you know, he's in the lap seat of Donald Trump. I have no idea where I'm going with this metaphor, although I'm starting to think of the Partridge Family bus, Matt, which, you know, it says like nervous in the back or careful, nervous president driving. That what Trump is going to want is a deal. And he's a master negotiator, which basically means that he just declares that he wins no matter what. I think you get Stephen Miller at the table. You're going to see a relatively clean DACA thing where it's like, yeah, people can be legalized and they get X billion dollars for a useless, impractical, ineffective border wall. And then everybody can walk away and say, oh, and we'll come back to these other issues later.
I just on the border wall, I feel like dumb border wall spending is dumb. On the other hand, to me, that's the least offensive
negative trade-off. Yeah.
Because it's a bunch of dumb spending, and we're never going to build a wall.
Where have we gotten to that we're willing to accept the idea of throwing, you know, by some estimates, $1 trillion into a big hole just because that's the least bad option?
I didn't say it was good.
I mean, they're talking puny, you know, and again, yeah,
they're talking,
this
goes to your
point,
like
$25 billion.
I understand that $1 trillion is not being appropriated.
They're
going
to lay some sensors. It's going to be like one of those electric dog fences, right? Except nobody's going to have the dog collar on. So people are just going to be like, it's going to keep
so
my dog
Peter
from
Suderman,
crossing to
you're
Mexico.
Coming out for dog collars for illegal immigrants?
No,
he
just compared Mexicans to dogs.
Now I've heard it all.
You're right. You've really, I take all of this back. My point is the border wall is going to be ridiculous. It's going to be a silly like thing. And while again, nobody on this call, on this teleconference, on this podcast, whatever the hell it is that we are recording here, is nobody's going to support the border wall spending. It seems to me like that's the easiest thing to give.
You know, the flip of all this is like, is it in anybody's interest to actually solve the DACA issue, or is it more fun for Republicans and Democrats and restrictionists and non-restrictionists, which isn't even the right term because, you know, the Democrats here are full of shit on this. When Hillary Clinton was, was senator from New York, she was very anti-illegal immigrant. The Democratic Party in 1996 was, you know, as Matt, you've pointed out in multiple pieces, was extremely anti-illegal immigrant. All of this kind of stuff, it's hard to believe. You know, Barack Obama actually deported, literally removed people who were in the country illegally and sent them packing at a higher clip than George Bush did. Neither of these parties wants to solve the immigration issue because it serves their current purposes. So I also wouldn't be surprised if, you know, because the only reason DACA is coming up, like they can keep the standoff going forever because Trump doesn't have to start deporting dreamers. He's got his hands full deporting other types of people. And Democrats don't really want to solve this either, because if they did, they would have when they controlled the White House, the Senate and the House of Representatives. I wouldn't be, you know, the premise for this is, or the warrant to act is a continuing budget resolution. And somehow they always find a way to keep spending money. So, you know, regardless of the issue of the moment. So I also wouldn't be surprised if things fall apart and we stop talking about this because government spending will get renewed anyway.
It's worth reading a little passage from Barack Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, in which he talked about immigration.
I'm about to give Peter a spoken word Grammy for this.
Yes,
so go
it's
going to
be it, this is my Bruno Mars moment. Native born Americans, wrote Obama, suspect that it is they and not the immigrants who are being forced to adapt. And if I'm being honest with myself, I must admit that I'm not entirely immune to such nativist sentiments. When I see Mexican flags waved at pro-immigration demonstrations, I sometimes feel a flush of patriotic resentment. When I'm forced to use a translator to communicate with the guy fixing my car, I feel a certain frustration. I mean, it's just amazing. You cannot imagine a Democrat. You can't imagine most Republicans saying that today. Or if they did, they would have been they'd be like, wow, that's really, I mean, you're just like a Stephen Miller too.
I just want to point out that as much as I am for Well, first of all, Nick, I think that your analysis is right looking backwards. I'm not sure that it's in terms of the both parties being kind of incentivized to do nothing and having the status quo go on. I'm not sure that is the case going forward in that. I think that there is strong motivation among at least grassroots Democrats to solve the immediate issue of the legal status of DACA recipients. There's also conflicting motivation, which is to stick a thumb in the eye of the racists. So that's problematic. But I think there's a bunch of people who would like to solve that. And on the Republican side, I think there's a bunch of people who would like to have their vision of immigration, which they feel helped win their presidency, ratified in law. So having those the people, instead of having the centrists, having the partisans, the polar opposites, negotiate maybe makes the motivation stronger, but it also makes their path more difficult and more.
Yeah, that's true. And you're right. I mean, you know, Tom Cotton and Senator Perdue, not Sonny Perdue, the other Perdue.
Will Perdue.
Yeah. But is, you know, it's I mean, they have legislation calling for a, you know, 50% cut in legal immigration, and to have something concrete that is working its way through the legislature is something different than we've seen in the past.
Good latte, I think, also in there. But I would just like to point out, as someone who was helping to prepare for a British friend of mine for him to get his citizenship quiz. And I kind of, you know, I'll be honest, I edited some of the questions that are out there on government citizenship area of the internet. I think that we should tailor our citizenship quizzes to maximally insult the country of origin. So just, you know, reiterating that it was King George, you know, what country was King George from that the Declaration of Independence was geared towards. I think it's important to flush them out just to see how much they blush or stammer as they're becoming American citizens going forward.
By the way, relatedly, Hamilton just made its way across the pond, as they horribly say, to London, and apparently the London audiences love the King George bits in Hamilton, where he's like a foofy idiot who hates America. So there's some self-hatred there that we could harness as well.
I think they just recognize every single British comedian there, you know, dressed up in drag.
Oh, is it Eddie Izzard? Is Eddie Izzard playing
oh my God.
King George?
That's amazing. That's a great idea. Like, Lin-Manuel Miranda, I assume you are listening. Make this happen.
Let's go to a lightning round of Eddie Izzard talk here before we peace out and prepare the path for tomorrow's special post State of the Union podcast, broadcast, Facebook live cast. Did I just join the cast of Hamilton?
I don't know, but you're starting to sound like Ed Cookie Burns from 77 Sunset Strip, where you're speaking in like a teen argo that nobody understands anymore.
That's phenomenal. Speaking of which, our mutual friend, Iowa Hawk, Dave Burge, was just yesterday on Twitter looking for 77 Sunset Strip and was chagrined to discover that it's just a freeway overpass between Denny's and the strip club. Anyways, apropos of nothing else.
Cookie, lend me your comb.
lightning round, anything having to do with Grammys, Hamilton, or the Academy Award nominations, which came out last week, I believe. We've all grown. It's been dog year since then. So, Peter, you're a movie person. Anything that you would like to say on any of those topics?
I've gotten a little softer on awards shows generally, and specifically the Academy Awards over the years. I used to be a real hater, and now, you know, I guess I kind of appreciate. And in particular, I think the awards have gotten better in the last couple of years. This year and last year, notably, it's a really good crop of Best Picture nominees. And what's really notable this year is that there's no Harvey Weinstein stinker. Right. Like there's always there for years. There was like a Miramax, like
they're removing potted plants from the
right. Like there was one of these things that Harvey just sort of like used his magical Oscars influence. I mean, it's really his business
model. You're saying Chocolat was it not a good movie?
Yes. He is saying that because that is a fact.
We are all
it's
saying
not
that.
A yes. fact.
Because
so say
it
we
is
all.
An absolute fact.
You guys are Alfred Molina haters. Go to hell.
This is a fundamental truth about the universe, Nick.
But the shape of water, the shape of water is in Best Picture. And like that, all that is a reverse gender inversion of the Incredible Mr. Limpet, the Don Knotts vehicle.
It's the best fish sex movie ever to be nominated for Best Picture.
The Phantom Thread sounds like a third-rate comic book hero.
The Phantom Thread is a really fascinating movie that I
look at. You're already going into
someday.
Your bullshit Please critic don't. Speak. Fascinating, fascinating movie.
I loved it. It's weirdly like a it's like a mashup of There Will Be Blood and Punch Drunk Love.
Virginia Pastrell was disappointed, and if anyone's going to be the correct authority on fabric movies, it's her.
Yeah, but it's not a movie about fabric.
Is
I mean,
it
it's about relationships, right?
It's about it's about the way that our lives are woven in a texture.
Stop!
Oh,
God,
I want to jump off the bridge, all of the bridges.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
Jesus
all I've got.
Christ.
I want to be good. I'll have more to say when we get closer to the ceremony.
The good thing about the Oscars is that you don't have to watch it. That's like the best thing about it, and also that I think Christopher Plummer is going to win every award because he's going to be digitally inserted into every movie by the time the Oscars actually air.
Catherine, as the mother of two children, what's the last calendar year that you saw a movie in a theater?
I don't even remember. Actually, I did see Wonder Woman, which was the wrong call. Of all the movies to go see.
Really?
I thought that movie was so hashtag problematic. Like the Indian guide dispensing wisdom in the middle, the lady being like, oh, in the end, all you need is love. It was a mess. Anyway, I'm glad Wonder Woman isn't winning anything. And other than that, my hot take is I am now reading the Harry Potter books with my children. We just finished book two. We are watching the movies each time we come around. Those movies are amazing and should have won all the Oscars at the end.
Yeah. Wow. That is a fantastic experience, and I had the benefit of reading Harry Potter along with your kids, and my older son actually
you read Harry
grew
Potter
up
to my
reading
kids?
With them.
Wow, that's a revelation.
I need more information. As a Hermione who is raising a Hermione, we have a lot to talk about from these books.
Just wait until Victor, what's his name? Victor Crumb makes an appearance. It'll induce puberty in
Stop,
your older daughter.
Nick, why? Stop it.
He is one sexy Bulgarian or Romanian.
Oh, dear Christ.
Read a book. Read a novel. It won't kill you.
Speaking of immigration.
God.
What?
Victor Crumb. Victor Crumb is coming to America.
The sexy Bulgarians.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that a skill that you can have?
Not only did I read those books,
they're an immigrant in short supply. Sexy Bulgarians.
I read those books to my daughter during the presidential election, and so I became one of those annoying people who was like, "Oh my God, the fourth and the fifth book. That's exactly with the Voldemorts and the Death Eaters, and they're doing all this."
Third Republican primary debate was exactly like the Triwizard Tournament.
It's
Matt,
exactly
should
like
I be
it.
Should I be worried? By the way, that my daughter's takeaway from book two is that she'd like to have a diary.
For sure. Although I will point out that my 9-year-old, who was then 7 or whatever, when we read the first one, said, "You know, I have a feeling that Ginny's going to be a really interesting character."
Spoiler alert! Wait, spoiler alert! Ginny is the worst, both in the movies and the novels.
Really, you're going to stake out the anti-Ginny Weasley position here?
She the worst. I mean, she is a wet dish rag, and Harry deserves better. I think.
Okay. Let's stop there.
You are just anti-dishwater blonde, Nick. No. And
she's
and
a redhead.
That kind of sexism is why it's time's up.
Yeah, she is a redhead.
Pal.
As are
and
all
speaking
the
of which, I will close out on my own observation about pop culture, which is that The Post, which is the only movie I think I've seen in the theaters that had nothing to do with children in a long time. It missed a great opportunity since it was very much in a kind of it was cast in feminist terms about the role of Katharine Graham and all this. And Meryl Streep is great, even though there's sort of some goopy moments in there.
Did it have Herblock giving involuntary massages in the Washington Post newsroom, as he was known to do?
It might as well have had Herb Luck like labeling scenes in the movie saying this looks yeah. just like something that's happening today Vultures. In modern contemporary America. Yeah. But the missed opportunity, which is golden and that you will see it if you watch the recent documentary made on Ben Bradley's life, is that they should have cast Ben Bradley as the villain. Because he was a piece of crap, that guy. There's sort of a nod in that direction if you're looking, straining your eyes really hard, as I believe his second wife, the model, gives him a talking to, gives him a little woman-splaining about how Kay Graham is the real hero and not him because she has more on the line. But it didn't talk about what just like a wife-leaving, child-abandoning, power-fluffing piece of over inebriated, pickled, ceremonial garbage Ben Bradley was in his personal life forever. So next time, Steven Spielberg, have the courage of your convictions and indict the hero of Watergate once and for all.
I'd have loved to have seen Tom Hanks play the Matt Welch take on Ben Bradley. Like Tom Hanks as villain Ben Bradley is great casting, actually.
Did he have those phony choppers that Ben Bradley was always sporting? Did he like get his teeth replaced for this role, Matt?
Nah, he just talks a little bit he talks a little bit gruff.
He does the horrible thing like Ben Bradley would do with his sort of like his belly and his slacks, his Hagar slacks, and just... It's an impersonation, so it's awful because no one wants to look at
who are Ben are Bradley. Woodward and Bernstein in this? I mean, I realize it's more about the Pentagon Papers, but
The final scene though is an inversion of the opening scene of All the President's Men, sort of leading you into
spoiler alert. You were the worst.
Are there any parking garage scenes?
It happened in real life.
It's literally saying the boat goes down at the end of Titanic.
Titanic sunk, guys.
Oh, wow.
And Luke died.
Were there any survivors?
No, Luke died.
Stop it.
Like Luke and Laura? That's
Matt,
it.
What was playing in the... you'll remember when Luke and Laura become an item involuntarily. What's playing at the discotheque? What song
Baby,
of your past?
Baby, come to me. No. Let me put my arms around you.
Herb Albert's Rise.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, the baby come to me. I want listeners to understand that I was correct in identifying the Luke and Laura theme music going forward after the rape that brought them together. And that's all the Me Too we have time for here on the Reason Podcast. Go to iTunes, subscribe to us, tell us how great we are, especially Nick. And again, please do listen to us Tuesday night at the moment and watch too, I think, on Facebook Live. The moment that the State of the Union address is over at reason.com. Thank you and see you next time.